This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Special deadlines that if you have individual retirement accounts, IRAs, that you should be aware of. And to find out more, let's check in with Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. Greg, thanks for joining us once again on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Well, this is very important. There, I guess, are several critical deadlines. I guess you could call them that we should know about. Tell us, first off, why they're critical, and we can go through them.
So a lot of people are familiar that the extension is October 15th, or I should say they are familiar with that when it comes to tax filings. But it's also a deadline when it comes to recharacterization or withdrawals from contributions made. Recharacterizations of Roth IRAs that were done in 2017, if you did convert one, you still have the opportunity to recharacterize. And it may be for various reasons. If the account didn't perform well and, you know, you converted at a higher rate than what it is today, or you decide that you didn't want that tax liability to come in for 2017, you still have that recourse.
Now, we're talking here, I guess, about converting traditional IRAs into Roth IRAs. And for any of our listeners that, for some reason, aren't familiar with Roth IRAs, the difference between the two, please give us an idea.
Yeah, so real quick, the traditional IRAs, the contributions are done as a pre-tax. So when you distribute the monies are considered income or taxable upon distribution. Where Roth IRAs, you forego the deduction today, but based on some time horizons as you wait, which is 5 years and 59 and a half, you essentially then can take all distributions tax-free. And there's several benefits to get into that. You know, obviously mitigating potential tax liabilities. They don't count as provisional income against Social Security. So there are some very large advantages of having Roth distributions in retirement.
I guess it would be wise then, I guess, to have a Roth IRA, especially if you have like an annuity where you'll have a distribution of in payments over a period of time. But those distributions are taxable, aren't they?
Yeah, so depending on whether your IRAs or annuities, which are deferred growth, where the distributions then become 100% taxable as either income and or interest, the Roth characterization allows you to take those distributions. And I think the significance this year, Chris, of this deadline is it is this opportunity has been removed with the new tax laws, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So there may be some confusion out there, people thinking, hey, we no longer can do it. And the answer is correct. You can no longer do it for conversions that you did this year. But the ones that you did last year still have the provision to recharacterize prior to October 15th.
So I guess it does give you an opportunity that if you've set up a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA and you've contributed to it and you have some second thoughts about it, you can make that change over now then.
Yeah, absolutely. And it could, like I said, it could be for several reasons. Generally, people will do it if there's a large decline in the value. It's like if I converted $10,000 and paid taxes on it, but it's worth $8,000, maybe I want to recharacterize it because it's only $8,000 now and I paid taxes on $2,000 additional dollars that I didn't need to. Because when you do recharacterize, just so everybody understands, you do pay the taxes from funds outside of that particular account. So it might be other reasons that are involved in it. Maybe the tax liability was more than people anticipated. They wanted to eliminate that tax liability. But primarily, those are some of the general reasons why you might reconsider the conversion.
Mm-hmm. Now, I also understand, too, that you may or may not have an IRA program set up through your employer. And that's a different deal as well, too. Or you have the opportunity, maybe, to create something even different, can't you?
Yeah, well, the biggest thing with the deadline is if you made contributions, one of the tough things about doing traditional IRA contributions outside of a company plan is they fall to income limitations and there's specific criteria to qualify for, in the case of both the traditional and Roth, the actual contribution, and in the case of the traditional, to actually count for a deductible contribution for your tax implications. So the opportunity that you have with this deadline is if you're not getting or did not get the full deduction that you anticipated getting, or you find out that you made contributions that you shouldn't have, you can remove them as a no harm, no foul. Otherwise, those excess contributions could create problems for you within the contract.
Do these make for some big confusing issues, especially if an employer is able to set up an IRA account for you and other employees?
Yeah, I mean, there's different limitations. The confusion is whether or not, you know, you're married or single, whether one spouse has what they call a qualified plan, or whether two spouses, or whether neither of them have. And then based on those particular criteria, it's based on family or household income, whether you be single or joint. So there's about three different parameters that come into play. And for some folks, they don't necessarily know where their compensation is going to end, especially if they have some type of commission-driven income or outside income source, or they had a significant raise or change in income that they weren't anticipating. Then by the time they get to year end, what was good the previous year, they find out no longer fit that criteria, and they do have the opportunity to recharacterize those contributions.
So we realize we've come into a situation that because the Trump administration and Congress have gone ahead and set all this up, and it's been passed and it's been enacted, that the changes in federal law have really made things more confusing, much more confusing than just different tax rates.
Well, and not only the confusion, I think, Chris, I think the biggest thing is the recourse is going to be a lot, it's just not going to be available.
Yeah.
You know, where if you made a mistake, most of the time, I would say probably close to 100% of the time, it's usually not intentionally, right? But now if you do something and you feel like it wasn't in your best interest, you're kind of committed to it now. So you just have to be a little bit more careful moving forward under these new laws. When considering a Roth conversion, making sure it's something that you will want to be committed to for the rest of your life, basically, because you will not have this opportunity to go back and say, hey, let me do this over. I rethought this, or my situation has changed.
Well, it sounds like that's the opportunity that you have now before the deadline on October 15th to get with your financial advisor, or with some financial advisor if you don't have one, get one chosen, and then be able to get this all set up so that you're in the clear and you're not going to pay these penalties that you're liable to pay here after the tax year to be sure, certainly.
Yeah, exactly, and you bring up the point or the reason why, because there is an excess penalty. It's actually a 6% excess contribution penalty. So if you made a contribution to an IRA that did not qualify, whether it be a traditional or a Roth, and you don't remove it, every year you accrue a 6% penalty of that contribution. So it's not, I mean, it's a pretty serious slap on the hand. So it's not something you want to take lightly. If it's in there, you need to get it out. If you get it out by the deadline, there's no penalty. If you get it out or sometime in the future, they'll go back and accrue that interest for all the years that it was in there that it shouldn't have been.
Boy, you'd hate to think that you might lose everything in your IRA account just because of penalties.
Yeah, and like I said, 6% is a pretty sizable excess penalty charge. So you just want to make sure for some reason, you know, a lot of people say, oh, you know what, didn't qualify, it's in there, I'm just going to leave it for investment, but they don't realize that there are consequences to those excess contributions.
Well, Greg, thanks for bringing all this up here, and hope that that people will realize they've got this deadline of October 15th to reach when it deals with either a traditional IRA or a Roth IRA in these cases here. And we appreciate you spending some time talking with us about it.
Yeah, and just one other thing I'll add real quick, Chris. You still have the opportunity to establish, you know, a SEP IRA if you're self-employed by this 15th of October as well, and still make a contribution, or an employer in that regards can still make a contribution to his simple IRA or SEP plans by this 15th if they had, in fact, filed an extension.
Well, time to go talk to the advisor about that, and thank you for spending some time with us today, Greg.
No problem, Chris. I always enjoy it.
That's a Northwest Indiana financial advisor, Greg Hammer. More cases of human trafficking are being identified around the country every year, including here in Indiana. Hospitals and medical professionals can play a large role in tackling the issue, but there are a number of challenges. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Lindsay Wright tells us, experts are implementing what they say is an easier and more efficient way to get healthcare workers the training that they need.
There's a small room tucked in an inconspicuous spot here at Community Health East. A lot of people won't ever know it's there. It's called the Center of Hope. It's where Robin Huberta, a forensic nurse examiner, spends her days.
As a forensic nurse examiner, I care for victims of violence who come through the emergency department.
The cabinets contain sexual assault kits, blood tubes. There's a single chair with stirrups and a couple cameras for documenting injuries. Huberta holds one with a bright blue light on the front of it. She flips off the room's overhead light.
This is to look for body secretions.
It's one of several procedures she may go through with people who've gone through traumatic experiences. Huberta says she does her best to be supportive. She sees all types of patients, including those who are victims of human trafficking.
We have a really unique role in healthcare that at some point these trafficked victims are going to need some type of medical treatment from a physician, whether it's to get antibiotics or to get on birth control or get pain medications or need a suture or something like that.
Huberta says simply recognizing a patient is being trafficked is difficult. They don't always know they're being trafficked, and their trafficker could be a significant other or even family member. But identifying cases is critical. According to the nonprofit anti-trafficking group Polaris Project, hospitals are the third point of access for those experiencing trafficking, right behind interaction with family and friends and law enforcement. So family nurse practitioner Christina Currier says getting healthcare workers the training they need is key.
It's not just physicians and nurses. It's security. It's the intake people, the triage people. Every point in that healthcare system, someone would be able to recognize if they're trained properly.
There are barriers in making that happen, though. Kate Kimmer works with the Indiana Coalition to End Sexual Assault. She says there's a lot that goes into training healthcare workers. It's not just teaching them to notice the red flags.
Okay, great. Like, you can tick a box, I identified somebody. But, like, seriously, then what? Who's your law enforcement partner? Who's your service providers you're referring to? How can you get that person help if they want it? Right? I mean, that's a kind of a bigger part of the conversation than just identifying.
And the next challenge is time. Healthcare providers are busy, so locking them into a comprehensive training seminar isn't easy. Members of the Indiana Protection for Abused and Trafficked Humans Task Force are launching a 90-minute webinar that hospitals can use to help their employees get the information they need and at a time that works for them.
That would be kind of that general call out that people could watch anytime and check their knowledge, make sure they know their knowledge, and would have access immediately to certain referral pathways and resources within the state of Indiana.
Depending on what your background in healthcare is.
A healthcare working group for IPATH gets a first look at that video, which includes information about trafficking laws and red flags. It also breaks down the stereotypical illustration of human trafficking.
Look at who your kids are going to school with. That's what human trafficking looks like. It looks just like you and I do.
Facilities across the state can use the webinar, then hospitals can request more training. An IPATH trainer would work with selected hospital staff, then those folks would take ownership of the training in their facility from then on out. Experts say it's a more sustainable and comprehensive way for hospitals to get on the same page. And Huberta thinks it's a step in the right direction.
We need to talk about how it impacts our community and how these people are coming through our hospitals and how we can make a huge difference with protecting them.
She says after receiving some training, community staff members identified more than a dozen trafficking victims in 2017. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Lindsay Wright.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time once again for Green Fleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction. Today, our guest is Mr. James Turnwalt. He's the Executive Director of the Michiana Area Council of Governments, or MACOG. James, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Carl. Thanks for having me.
So remind our listeners, what is MACOG, James?
So MACOG is a regional planning organization that covers St. Joe, Elkhart, Kosciuszko, and Marshall County. And we provide varying services for our entire region and the local government, typically around planning functions, and we're best known for doing planning for transportation.
So I know that you have a big plan that you're working on, the 2050 plan, in the works for St. Joe, Elkhart, Marshall, and Kosciuszko counties. So why is MACOG undertaking this long-range transportation plan?
Yeah, so one of the many functions that we serve is we serve as what's called a Metropolitan Planning Organization, or an MPO, and we also serve as a Rural Planning Organization. And so it's our responsibility under federal law to produce a 20-year long-range transportation plan, and we have to update that every 4 years. And so we're in the process of planning for and creating what we're calling Michiana on the Move, a 2045 transportation plan.
I see. So we know the population in the MACOG region is expected to rise over the next 20 years. So how does population growth impact the transportation network?
Yeah. So we've broken down the transportation plan, the planning process, really, into three main functions. And the first area that we focus on is a section that we call how we grow, because the transportation network is affected by population growth. And so what we've done is a series of different surveys and tabletop exercises with folks to look at the different ways in which the region could grow, whether that's a high growth or a low growth or no growth, and then the patterns in which that growth occurs, whether that's much more in a rural area or much more in a urban area, and how that all will affect the transportation network. And we're creating different scenarios around that input of how we grow to see how it affects the transportation network.
I see.
The next phase is then we'll look at the how we move and the what we value. But that first key foundational element is looking at growth.
So what types of stakeholders are involved in this planning process?
Yeah, so we work with a diverse set of stakeholders because the transportation network ultimately encompasses for us walking, biking, driving, and riding public transit. So we work with units of local government, public transit providers, freight stakeholders, advocates for walking and biking, as well as then a whole litany of other stakeholders and just the general motoring public as well. And so we offer a number of different opportunities for all of those stakeholders to be involved in our planning process.
You're listening to Green Fleet Radio. Today, our guest is Mr. James Turnwald. He's the executive director of MACOG. So James, as the public, and again, I know the public is involved with everything, but how do they get involved with this process?
Yeah, so during our How We Grow phase, we had a public survey that encouraged folks to participate, which was like a 5-minute survey that asked about different preferences that they had about what they envision growth looking like for the MACOG region. And we'll have a number of other public surveys that are available for the how we move and what we value phase. And so folks can find out more as we go through that process by going to move2045.macog.com.
So, James, as we talk about this plan, is there anything, any model that you follow for this plan?
Yeah, so there are federal requirements of what needs to be in the plan. And generally, we try to build off of what we did 4 years ago, because this is something we have to do every 4 years. And so every 4 years, we're trying to make sure that we're creating a better plan. And so for us, that is focused on trying to get better input into the creating different scenarios, because we're not trying to necessarily predict the future. Instead, what we're trying to do is see what various future scenarios look like for the region and what set of transportation projects best addresses those various different futures.
I see.
Because that helps us create a better portfolio of projects, essentially, and make better investments into the transportation network.
I see. And again, I know there's been so much development in the MACOG area. So, you know, as we hear every day on local media about autonomous vehicles, so how is this implemented into the 2045 plan?
Yeah, I think it'd be hard to have a plan that looks so far into the future and not address autonomous and connected vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
So we have, and this is new to our plan, this 2045 plan. It is brand new that we'll have a section that looks at some different modeling scenarios that talks about what the implications of autonomous and connected vehicles could be to the region, and generally looks at different policies that local governments should be looking at be ready for autonomous and connected vehicles. So it is something that we are looking at for this plan, which is new for us.
You know, I know MACOG has always been notorious for looking outside of the box in regards to growth and in regards to transportation planning. You've done some wonderful things for the state of Indiana and obviously the MACOG region. But as we move forward, what are some of the things that potentially you are going to be thinking outside of the box on this plan?
Yeah, so a number of the different things that we'll be looking at, as we've discussed, is the autonomous and connected vehicles, to see what policies maybe need to be in place so we set the right groundwork or framework for the integration of those into our transportation network. Additionally, we'll be looking at alternative fuel vehicles and what applications they could have in municipal settings or in public settings to improve the ability for electric or other types of alternative fuel vehicles to be operating within the region, because we see both of those as future trends, as well as then just looking at these different scenarios to consider what the best investments are in the transportation network, and understanding that we all have a finite set of resources, and that if we can find the a good investment strategy, essentially, that's what we're kind of using this plan for. So those different modeling scenarios, I think, will help us get to that and kind of figure out what projects we value the most.
Sure. Just exciting times. Keep up the good work. Thank you for all the great work that you've done in the past. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to James Turnwell, Executive Director of MACOG. I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. You can catch Green Fleet Radio on Wednesdays here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio 89.1 FM. And podcasts for Green Fleet Radio are always on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, or you can pick it up on NPR One on your smartphone app. Just search for WLPR. This is Regionally Speaking. The reason that he was in the first time was because he had just won a federal jury judgment in his favor. I guess in part, it wasn't total, but it was pretty important, to be sure, against the Hanover Community School Corporation in Cedar Lake. And he had in turn sued over, I guess, the right basically to work, wasn't it? That was what it came down to, that you had been fired from your job and you were saying I'm not being represented properly and being getting treated fairly.
Yeah, well, the whole thing was a mess from the get-go. They actually lied to me from the very beginning. The new principal that came in, his name is Justin Biggs. Had two great principals before that with Mr. Joe Fetty and Mr. Bob McCray. And then this character came in from Hammond, from the school city of Hammond, named Justin Biggs. Never been a principal before. And then all of a sudden he decided after my 8 years of service at the corporation, all excellent evaluations, that he was going to eliminate all the classes that I taught. Mine was the only classes that he decided to do that to. And then I was told that they were going to – it was a reduction in force. They called it a RIF.
Right.
And then after the lawsuit got filed and so forth, the school board refused to meet with me and violated my due process rights as a jury determined in the federal trial. And the following school year, as after they told me that they were going to reduce the teaching force, they actually increased it by 12 or 13 teachers. So they actually increased the teaching force. So they lied about the reason from the get-go and then didn't want to meet with me about it, which got them in trouble.
Now, of course, this all ended up going to court in federal court in Hammond. What's unique about this is that typically this would be a case that would have an attorney alongside the person who is facing the school, in this case, the school board, about the matter, about losing job, not being properly allowed to be able to have due process and in meeting with your school board members about the issues. But you chose to fight alone. You decided to take this case on what is known in the legal profession as pro se. Explain, if you will, for folks that aren't familiar as much with pro se, what that is, what that all involves. It's a very involved process, certainly for someone like this, I'm sure.
Yes, Chris. Pro se, it's a Latin term meaning for oneself. So you go to court if you're pro se, you do it without a lawyer, for oneself, for yourself, and then you just, you know, you just represent yourself just like a lawyer would, and you're expected to follow all the rules and so forth. They make that very clear, and that was my decision to do. To be quite honest about it, I have a very low opinion of the legal profession, lawyers. It's just something that long ago I learned that saw a lot of things happening, and I just don't trust lawyers. It's usually about money. It's usually about power and so forth, and very little to do with the actual issues and cases. They want the quick buck, and to me, the issue of the cases are very important. So I decide that I just basically don't trust lawyers in general, and I wanted my case was issue-oriented, and that's the direction that I took it.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're an educator by profession, a licensed teacher, and I guess your interest in the law went back a number of years, I understand.
Yes, many years back. I know we don't have enough time to get into a whole lot of details here, but back it started in 1981. I was in a bank with my mother in Valparaiso. Saturday morning, we were going to do some banking, and there was a problem in the bank's parking lot, and the police were called, and me and my mom walked into the bank, and then they came in and attacked me and put me up against the wall and roughed me up pretty good. And the bank people were trying to tell them that it wasn't me that they were after. But along the way, they had roughed me up pretty good, actually. And then once they finally realized they had the wrong person, and rather than just apologizing to me and letting me go, they went ahead and charged me with some ridiculous charge. I believe it was disorderly conduct. They had to charge me with something so it would make it look like what they did was legitimate when it wasn't. And we went to court. Now, back then, I did hire a lawyer, and we went to court, and the judge found me not guilty, acquitted me of the charges, and he chastised the Valparaiso police and told them that what they should have done was apologize to me. And rather than apologize to me and let me go, they charged me with a ridiculous charge. And then after that, the nightmare began. Then I just started getting arrested one time after. By the very next arrest, by the same exact officer, there was a lawsuit filed. There was an out-of-court settlement. They got upset about it. And then I got I couldn't go to the store without getting arrested. And that's where things started getting deep with lawyers. It started getting very expensive. And I started noticing things that were going on where I just wasn't trusting the lawyers that I had hired and paid. I just saw things going on with the other side, with the lawyers that I didn't like, and I decided to learn the law by myself. And then I started representing myself in several of the criminal proceedings and was successful, and then just started learning more about the law and learning more about the law and just got lawyers completely out of my life and was able to go in and actually win this federal trial.
One of the things that your book goes into, of course, as you mentioned, the problems that you ran into over the years here that got you into this feeling that lawyers, in your opinion, were not to be trusted. And then you go to the case involving the Hanover Community School Corporation after being dismissed from your job and in turn filing the paperwork. What reaction did you get when the paperwork got filed before the trial even began?
Well, the judge, it was Judge Philip Simon. He's the chief judge of the Northern District of Indiana. I think he's a pretty good guy. I don't think he's a corrupt judge by any means, but I think he's a government-friendly type judge. And he certainly made it very clear to me that he was not happy that I chose to represent myself. So we did have words over that. And on a couple of different occasions throughout the proceedings, and I made it very clear to him that I would be representing myself, and he didn't like it. And so I went in, and the last right before the trial, I walked out of his courtroom. He gave me an extremely dirty look, actually told me that I wasn't going to win my case, he told me, which I thought was inappropriate, and I told him so. And then he actually even threw a little threat out to me that the corporation was offering – they were trying to offer me $150,000 to settle the case so we wouldn't go to trial. And I turned that down. I said no. And he got upset about that. I told him that the issue was more important than the money. And he didn't seem to have much enthusiasm for that response and was very upset about it. So he wasn't happy. But that's why they're under the Judiciary Act of 1789. All people in this country are entitled to represent themselves under congressional law. And I think the federal judges are missing that point. They're missing that law. I'm not sure if they even know about that law, to be
quite
honest.
It's very possible. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And they probably didn't learn that, or maybe they just turned it as in passing when they went to law school.
Yeah. Well, you would think that as a federal judge making more than $200,000 a year on a lifetime appointment, that they would know the laws. They would know the laws. And I'm not saying that he didn't, but if he did know the law, that makes it actually even worse. And he's not the only one. I talk to a lot of pro se litigants from all over the country. They call me constantly. I help a lot of people, and I hear the same stories from judges abusing and mistreating pro se litigants all across the country. I actually wrote an op-ed in the Washington Examiner about this issue. It's very important.
You also got a good write-up, I guess, so to speak, in another book that deals with pro se, which was a book I'm sure that young attorneys, people going to law school, get the chance to read, I would imagine.
Yes. I would think that the law schools would probably have my book as a required reading, actually, because they need to understand how the pro ses think and how they operate, and they're going to have to deal with them, because actually across the United States, more than in the state and federal courts, there's a study made that at least 50% of the cases that are filed in the United States are by pro se litigants for one reason or another.
Mm-hmm.
And I should add that Judge Richard Posner, who wrote the foreword for my book, retired from the Seventh Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals about a year ago or so, and he has been standing up for pro ses and started a firm, the Posner Center for Justice for Pro Ses, which I help him with. So he's been a stand-up person and he's very critical of the judges for not respecting the pro se rights.
Now, these days, we know that that you've kind of retired from the business of education in a way. You're not in a school teaching shop any longer, we know, but you are busy, apparently, with a lot of things. As you mentioned, you've kind of alluded to the fact that you do a lot of work with helping organizations with the issue of pro se representation.
Well, yes. I'm a educator, a teacher by trade, and even though I'm not teaching in the school corporations, I'm still trying to educate people on the goings-on in the legal world. So people will understand things that it's very important. The courts are very important. They affect people's everyday lives on a major magnitude level. And so now I'm devoting the rest of my life to educating people about how the court system operates, the things that are going on, the things that need to be changed so that people can be treated more fairly by the court system, which I think is a major problem in the country.
Can you give us an example, without mentioning names or places, I suppose, on one of the instances where you've been able to help somebody out who's dealing with a problem, probably not unlike what you faced in Cedar Lake?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've got a lot of them. For example, Judge Posner and I helped a person write a petition for writ of certiori, it's called. A person was suing a corporation for a copyright infringement violation. So I got involved with that case, and that case is pending before the United States Supreme Court as we speak here today. And there's several others. I mean, and there's a lady that's got a case in California that I've been helping with her case, and she's been putting up with a lot of abuse from the judge in her case. He happens to be a judge in the Southern District of Indiana, and she has a magistrate in her case who's been ruling against her, and she called me for help. And then she found out that this magistrate and the opposing lawyer on her side were law partners for 14 years. And then I advised her how to handle that situation by filing her complaint and so forth. So she's done that.
Yeah, have you heard back on that one?
It's still pending.
Okay.
It's still in the process. So hopefully, I'm to be honest about it, I'm not real optimistic because of the way the court system is set up. It's very difficult for people to bring complaints against judges because judges, the system in place is judges review the other judges' conduct when there's a complaint made. And I feel very strongly that there should be citizen input on those types of panels to review misconduct charges against judges.
Well, Brian, thank you very much for spending time with us for a little while today, talking not only about your book, which is out, it's entitled Motion for Justice, I Rest My Case, but talking a little bit about your situation as a shop teacher, a former shop teacher now with the Hanover Community School Corporation. And we trust that even though the matter's probably still involved in the appeals process one place or another, I'm sure the school district was not going to give up on this. They didn't want to have to give up any more money than they probably felt they already had. I'm sure that we'll hear more about this over time, but we thank you for spending some time with us to talk about your situation, about what you've been doing now for a lot of other people who have found themselves in the same sort of situation, and the book that you've just put out, too. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks, Chris. It was my pleasure.
For veterans, the Appeals Modernization Act that passed last year, it's kicked off a much-needed change in the veteran benefit appeals process, and the VA is trying to transform the appeals process to make it quicker and make it more efficient for those that are seeking appeals, and keep up with the growing pace of appeals as well as number. We have with us Dave McClanahan, who's the director of VA's Appeals Management Office, to talk about it. Dave, thanks for joining us here on the program today.
Well, thanks for having me. This is very important information for your listeners in the Chicagoland area, and I guess Indiana as well.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of veterans live in the area.
Well, we do, because the Jesse Brown VA Medical Center out of Chicago and its accompanying outpatient clinics include Indiana. In fact, there's one just about 2 miles away from our studios, as a matter of fact, in Crown Point. So we're close by, and a lot of veterans, even for those who live to the east of us directly, are being helped as well, too, even though they may, because of their distance, they may be taking advantage of the service that allows them to be able to see a local practitioner or a local healthcare provider, if need be, for their services here. But there's a new law, I understand, of course, dealing with the veteran benefit appeals process. And tell us first what the problems seem to be.
Generally, what we're talking about here is veterans that have a disability compensation claim.
Mm-hmm.
That's the vast majority of our appeals. It's about 95% of all appeals. So it's generally not a health care claim. It's more of a monetary benefit claim for veterans that have service-connected disability.
Yeah.
And so as far as the issue of why there are so many appeals, you can really look back for several decades, and the appeal rate has always been relatively the same, about 11 to 12% of all decisions that are made. So what happened is as we increased our claim processing, to where we are now deciding every year well over a million claims, you're always going to get that 11 to 12% appeal, and the current system is simply not built to handle that kind of burden. So it was really a process that developed over a long, long time, and it just is not serving veterans well now, and I think we all came to an agreement that we needed to design something new.
Does it seem like that it's turned out that the old process that is being updated by the new law was just too cumbersome, I guess, too complicated, maybe?
Yes, I think that's it's too complex, too slow, and I don't know if your listener is aware of this, but on average, it's taken about 3 to 7 years for veterans to get a resolution of their appeal in the current process. So we were essentially just falling further and further behind. And that's simply because of the nature of the system that was provided to us in our legislation, which kept the record on the appeal open throughout the appeal so veterans could file additional information. We'd have to re-adjudicate the claim. And we also have a continuing duty to assist throughout the process. So, again, we just needed to pull it apart and redesign it, and that's what's in this new law that the president signed about a year ago now.
Now, what are the three appeals review options that veterans have if they don't happen to agree with the initial claims decisions?
Right, so that's one of the key features of the new law is it gives veterans choice, something that they don't have now. So, for example, if they have some additional evidence and they want VA to continue to help them develop their claim, they can file a supplemental claim, and we'll process that just like we do initial claims in about an average of 125 days. Secondly, if they believe that there was an error made in the prior decision, they can ask for a higher-level review by a more experienced employee, and that higher-level reviewer will look at the evidence that was before the prior decision-maker and see if he or she can make a different decision or identify an error. And again, we'll process those. Our goal is an average of 125 days. And then finally, Veterans that want to appeal to the Board of Veterans Appeals can appeal directly to the board in lieu of going through the Veterans Benefits Administration, for example. That's something that's not available under current law. Allows them to get an immediate review by a veterans law judge. And the goal there is to do those more formal appeals in an average of about 1 year if the veteran selects the fastest route at the board. Mm-hmm.
Now, if we should mention, too, that, that as a result of the new law that's in effect, there's what's called RAMP, which is what this program's called, the Rapid Appeals Modernization Program. Who is eligible for this program? And you've talked about some of the advantages. I'm sure there are probably plenty of them.
Right. We wanted to demonstrate our commitment to veterans that currently have appeals pending. So in your listening area, that's about 18,000 veterans that have an appeal pending right now.
Mm-hmm.
And because their appeal is already pending, the law that goes into effect in February isn't going to help them right away. They're already in this appeal process we have now. What we're doing is we're allowing them through this RAMP program to opt into the new system. They can do that now. All they have to do is file one of those supplemental claims or ask for a higher level review. And the good news is that there's already about 50,000 veterans that are participating in this program, and they're getting decisions within that 125-day goal that we've set. And we've already paid more than $50 million in retroactive benefits. So the program is working for veterans. We just need help with people such as you to get the word out to veterans to use this program.
We're talking with Dave McClenahan, who is the director of VA's Appeals Management Office, about this new program passed last year in law by Congress and signed by the president on the Veterans Benefit Appeals process. Now, what would happen to a pending appeal if a veteran should decide not to participate in this in RAMP, this new program?
All right, so RAMP is voluntary. We can't force veterans to use it. It's better for them if they do use it, but it is voluntary. So a veteran can choose to stay in the current process. And the vast majority of our resources are on those legacy appeals. We'll continue to work them, and it's our goal to work them down as quickly as we can. But there are inherent delays in the current process. Everybody agrees to that, and that's why the new law was enacted. But we will continue to work those appeals if veterans choose to stay in that process. Mm-hmm.
Now, since this is a new program, how can veterans make a decision on which of the RAMP options might work best for them?
Well, first of all, we always recommend that they consult with their representative if they have one and ask about which choice they should make. But I would like to point out that another key feature of the new system is that veterans really can't make a mistake in choosing an option.
Oh.
What I mean by that is that once they choose one of those two options, supplemental claim or higher level review, and they get a decision, the other options are still available. There's never a penalty that affects the veteran's date that their benefits will start. So that's also good news for veterans. You can't really make a mistake in the new process.
Now, if people are interested, if veterans in particular and family members we've been listening to this are interested, where can they go if they do have questions about their appeals or maybe some assistance?
Right. So other than talking to their representative,
yeah,
there is a lot of information that's available on our website, benefits.va.gov. That includes information on the RAMP program and other initiatives that we have going, and they can find the RAMP election document online that they can send to us to get into the RAMP program.
Well, David, thank you very much for spending time with us to explain this new program. This seems to be, appeals reform seems to be one of the biggest changes that that we've seen come out of the Department of Veterans Affairs in quite some time, and we're glad to see this new program get pushed in and put on fast track, I guess, to put into effect. Thank you for being with us to explain it for us today.
You're welcome. This is one of our highest priorities, and we're looking forward to implementing the law in February.
David McClenahan is the director of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs Appeals Management Office. What happens to household pesticides? Well, a man in Bloomington asked the question, and Indiana Public Broadcasting's Rebecca Teal answered.
Eric Rensberger of Bloomington wanted to know how to dispose of some leftover Roundup pesticide he had in his basement.
I wanted to get rid of it, and I thought, but you can't just, dump it on the ground.
So, what do you do with leftover Roundup? The short answer is, you can drop it off at your local hazardous waste facility. which for Rensburger is at Monroe County Hazardous Materials in Bloomington, next to the recycling center. But Rensburger had other questions. How do they dispose of the Roundup? And how do workers that handle it stay safe? To answer these questions, we asked Scott Morgan, the operations director of the Monroe County Solid Waste Management District.
The biggest thing we take in terms of volume and commonality is paint. Paint, electronics, household cleaners, pesticides, insecticides, herbicides, all those kinds of things. So a lot of things you're going to find in your garage, in your under your sink.
Morgan says when people drop off their leftover pesticides, they first have to fill out a form.
And then we're going to take it back here to a scale and weigh it so that we can quantify numerically how much we're diverting from a landfill.
If it's still able to be used and safe, it would go on a shelf where Monroe County residents can pick it up for free. If not, the whole sealed container goes in a lined 55-gallon steel drum. Once that drum is full, Morgan says, it gets shipped to Indianapolis and eventually ends up at a facility in East Liverpool, Ohio, where it's incinerated.
And the reason they do incineration versus landfilling is because once you burn it, the kind of your liability and your hazard goes away.
Morgan says the entire steel drum gets chucked in the incinerator.
They're able to pull that metal back and still recycle it after they're done.
To listener Eric Rensburger, this all sounds pretty hazardous for employees.
These people have to handle this and all kinds of other things. What precautions do they take?
Morgan says the Monroe County Hazardous Waste staff goes through training every year.
Complacency does happen on occasion, I'm sure, but it's something that we really try to pay attention to and help each other. Mm-hmm. Say, hey, don't forget to put your gloves on. What about your glasses? If safety boots are forgotten, you know, hey, don't forget to go put your safety boots on, you know, those types of things. So we really try to help each other remember to do things safely so that you go home to your family.
Morgan says the staff also gets yearly blood and urine screenings.
We do about 6 or 7 vials of blood where they're checking heavy metals, you know, everything possible where if we have an exposure in here, they're going to medically see that, then they can treat that based on what they see.
Rensburger says coming to the hazardous waste facility was a neat experience.
I had a wonderful time. I had a great field trip.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Rebecca Thiel.
And Rebecca and other reporters are asking for questions. To be able to search for the answers, you can go online to wfiu.org/inquireindiana and find out more. Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie is joining us in the studio now to answer your pet's questions on Ask Ollie. The pet questions are voiced by woman-human Victoria Voller, and Ollie's responses are voiced by man-human Tom Maloney. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Dear Ollie, I was told that whenever I board my dog, taking an item of my own personal clothing for him to have in his boarding crate is comforting for him when he's in a strange place. I always wondered if this is an old wives' tale. Is there any science behind it? Or is it really true? Signed, Marilyn from Dyer.
Dear Marilyn, the scent of a woman. Or in this case, a woman human. I know that when I go away, I find my woman human scent comforting because it reminds me of safety, security, and a big dog dish piled high with canine appropriate goodies. One of my housemates suffers from a case of acute separation anxiety. When he's left behind, even in the safety of our own home, he feels vulnerable and tries frantically to get to our humans outside by chewing the door frame into pieces or digging underneath the door. This behavior has caused much yelling and wringing of our woman-human's hands. Once, when we came home from a short shopping trip to Valparaiso, he had collected together items that all of my house humans had touched or worn. He actually surrounded himself with a variety of things bearing their scent. In fact, he even collected the remote control from the television area along with some funky old pink slippers, socks, and a t-shirt with Go Bears printed on it. He felt safe. In his head, this was a good way of letting a potential house intruder know that they had better stay away. The familiar scent of a dog's owner lingers like perfume in a dog's brain, according to scientist Gregory Burns of Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. He says, When humans smell the perfume or cologne of someone they love, they may have an immediate emotional reaction that's not necessarily cognitive. Our experiment may be showing the same process in dogs. Dogs are social creatures with a very strong desire to be with others like themselves or humans. If they are deprived of the social contact they need, there may be barking and howling and panic resulting in the sudden need to do their business, leaving a mess wherever they are. Dogs show preferences for different people and for different dogs. Their ability to process scent is 40 times better than ours, so their world is defined by the use of their nose. Humans use their hands and eyes to explore the world, so we are very different in a zen sort of way. A dog's vision is not as detailed as ours, so they recognize different objects by smell and shape rather than by detail and texture. So yes, Marilyn, it is a very good idea to bring an object with a scent for your dog when he is away from home. However, be careful whose scent is on the object. Make sure it's not the scent of that cat or a competitive dog. Marilyn, in your case, it should always be the scent of a woman, human, and that would be you. Signed, your friend in fur, Ollie. And remember, love is a four-letter word.
If you have a question for Ollie, you can email it to ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia.org. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana. Coming up this coming Saturday, October 13th, the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana is hosting a three-alarm adoption event. It'll be at the Highland Fire Department's annual open house, which is from 10 a.m. until 3 p.m., and it's in downtown Highland. On Saturday, November 3rd, the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana hosts its annual Concert for Critters. That'll be at the Memorial Opera House in Valparaiso. And tickets for that event are available at memorialoperahouse.com. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and we'll check in with Brandon Smith from Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and Doug Gross from the Times of Northwest Indiana. And we'll have more for you as well on Reporters Roundtable Thursday.